we're back, and we did the selected poems of Vincent Farini, 1975, and this book, our pamphlet, was produced by Amiel and his friends in New York City, and there are copies right here for anyone, so maybe we can all, like, follow along. Everybody should probably just grab a copy so you can...
There
to use.
I'm just passing that way. Willie?
So, Amiel's here, and I love these poems, and I love Vincent. And the one poem that means the most to me, or that I keep going back to, and I read a lot on 4th of July, was What the Books Left Out. And so I just want to share that poem with you guys, and maybe we can... tell each other what we know about some of the figures that are mentioned in there. This is on page 35. So I'm going to give it a go reading. Okay. So, What the Books Left Out. The school teachers read the dates, and like puppets of self-interest, stunted minds with lies, but in the scars of tenements, the truths of Sacco and Vanzetti sprout branches. The Ludlow butchered walk the streets now. From the cemeteries, the eyes of the massacred Memorial Day marchers come out of cul-de-sacs. These hours, our activities weld the atoms of Mooney and McNamara. Joe Hill plays in the shadows of black houses, the ashes of John Brown, lecture from street corners, speeches of Eugene Debs light the cells of political prisoners, trees drop lynched Negroes coming to life, the tarred and feathered, the testicle-kicked labor organizers, the killed strikers, the bulge in the wombs of tenements. The words of Lincoln are leaving the books, speaking from the mouths of the poor. Old women's wrinkles tell histories. Old men bring lanterns for the road of the present, and the kitchen kettle sizzle with people's brewing. Vincent Farini.
Yeah, it really brings that history back, boy.
So I love this poem because, like Diane de Prima's poetry, you can take one line, the truths of Sacco and Vanzetti sprout branches. And I say to myself, who's Sacco and Vanzetti? What's up with Sacco and Vanzetti? So I want to find out who they are. And they were, like Vincent, if I'm getting this right, Sacco was a shoe cutter, one of the best shoe cutters down in, he lived in Plymouth, I believe, and Bartolome Vanzetti was not a shoe cutter, but a fish peddler. Which is really, I don't know. For some reason, I just thought of Jesus. I don't know if he comes in this, but so Vincent has given us something that after this class, you could come back in here and check out who these people are. Charles Olson had the letters of Sacco and Vanzetti. He has multiple books of criticism about the case, and. You could come back here and check it out. Woody Guthrie has a great record that I didn't know about. I knew about Woody Guthrie for 8 years. I didn't know Woody has this wonderful 7-track record called The Ballads of Sacco and Vanzetti. To find out who these people are. And what I know about Sacco and Vanzetti, Henry said something about this last week. If you were alive in the beginning of the 20th century, this was huge. It wasn't just Italians, it wasn't just the working class. The amount of concern and movement around the arrest of these two men and the Judge Webster Thayer called them anarchist bastards. So, like all of these cases, it didn't happen like they were just hanging out and they were random guys and they got scooped up. They were doing something before and it were fomenting a working movement. And so much so that there was a directory. This is the beginning of the, not the beginning, we're at least two decades into the FBI collecting addresses and stuff, but there's a huge going through people's mails and trying to figure out who these people are. And it's definitely going to spook them because, like I brought up last week, the Wobblies were taken out in 1915, I'm going to say with the death of Joe Hill. This is a huge, a big problem for the Wobblies, and a lot of them were disappeared and killed. But here we are, so Sacco and Vanzetti are executed. Does anybody know the date? Because I know it. Does anybody?
14, was it?
I believe that it was 1927 that they were executed.
Yeah. Vincent was 14.
Yeah, exactly.
Vincent was 14.
Yeah.
At Bunker Hill Community College. That's where they killed. That's why it's called Prison Point, at Bunker Hill. It was a prison. And that's why the bridge is called the Prison Point Bridge. That's where the prison was.
Jim, that's why?
And there was a big march in Boston. In the North.
That's where it was, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So this is exactly the only reason why I'm happy that you all are here. And if you came and told me that you didn't want to read in peace, I would bother you and talk to you all day.
And Vincent's father was like an anarchist, so it would make sense that, you know, he would be very attuned to what was happening then.
He lived in the house, so heard the names in the house.
Also. I could read just this thing from my intro here.
Yeah, please.
Says, as he wrote in his autobiography, page 2, as he wrote in his autobiography, Hermit of the Clouds, Green's parents were immigrants of the 1909 wave of the poor and had come from southern Italy to work in the shoe factories. Born in the New World as Venanzio Ferrini, under the sign of the patron saint of his father's old world hometown of Raiano in Abruzzi, life's drama intruded upon his earliest memories. The tenement I am born in has a placard worn out, torn, weather-beaten like the clapboards, but the writing still legible. When will the long feud end? With the emergence of strong anarchist and labor movements in New England, Ferrini's parents, Rina De Carlo and Giovanni Ferrini, found themselves in the midst of political and economic turmoil, as so many key incidents of the period took place in their immediate environs. Bartolomeo Vanzetti, an omnivorous reader, just like Giovanni's son Vincent would become, met his first anarchist comrades in Worcester in 1912, and Vanzetti sent in his first 25-cent contribution to Luigi Galeani's essential anarchist journal, the Italian language Cronaca Sovversiva, which had recently relocated to Lynn from Barre, Vermont, that same year. They went up to Vermont because a lot of them were stone workers. So right. They worked in the quarries there. Because all the marble, the White House, for instance, is from Barre.
It's Barry.
Barry, yeah. Some
That's
people
how you pronounce that
yeah.
name that town is Barry.
Since Ferrini characterized his parents as non-practicing Catholics and my father as a Christian anarchist, it's certain that Cronaca would have made an appearance in the already politicized Ferrini household. Anyways, it goes on, and there's a section about his, you know, what happens to his sister, but after that it says on page 4, already having witnessed death firsthand, Ferrini was a teenager when there is a public murder and the state sizzles a harmless fish peddler and a humble cobbler, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti in 1927. He went to work in a shoe factory and tannery, but his father's judgment, having himself been an aspiring opera singer, that he was born in the wrong class to be a poet, led him to discover the public library. And then it goes
That's
on
a great
from there.
Introduction.
Yeah, that's great.
I also wanted to continue about that poem
yeah.
a little bit.
Yeah, right? Sure, sure. Yeah, I just wanted to bring in the stuff about Vanzetti.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you picked that poem. And I was reading again closely because on page 46, in these amazing letters, right, Vincent is getting advice about what kind of poet he should be. It starts on page 45. It starts on page 45. I wrote in the margin, so Hecht is talking that poetry of affirmation lasts the longest. And so he, you know, at the risk of, he certainly doesn't want to derail what Vincent is doing, but let's see.
Yeah, your point.
Alex Bergman.
45, now, there's no such thing as setting up a mechanical equation. Poetry of affirmation has a stronger, lengthier, broader appeal. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, first he's talking about Alex Bergman at the top, mm-hmm. who infused a tenderness and lyricism into a song of the greatness, the anonymous greatness, of those who struggled in the progressive movement, so that it gripped not only those who politically agreed, but anybody of any political conviction with a capacity for appreciation. It has that rare inspirational quality and depth that reaches out for approval and identification. And so in contrast, if you want to at some point look at the poems early in this book, or even some of these in this pamphlet that was reproduced, you'll see that Vincent's early poems when he was young were very agitational, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that and so this is the advice that he's getting is don't leave it at that. Agitational meaning pointing out stuff that'll get people angry, and the horrible stuff that's going on, mm-hmm. and the suffering and the starvation and. The getting people off their back, whatever that symbolizes, and so this is so on page 46. This is Hecht still talking. So that people will fight back and they will win unequivocally and irrevocably, and in the not too distant future, this is a special kind of vision. He wanted Vincent to show hope in his poetry. So if I'm not going to go on, but those two pages have a lot of stuff about
Joe Hill there.
Yeah.
Right, have a lot of stuff about this man urging him to add this to his poetry. So if we go back to the poem that you read, you know,
Coming Alive. Yeah, that's totally it.
Oh, if you go back to almost every stanza, what the book's left out, 35, at first I was... First you see, you know, puppets of self-interest, stunted minds with lives. They let that out, the scars of tenements, the truths. But he said the truths of Sacco and Vanzetti sprout branches. Mm-hmm. So in every stanza, there's something there like that. From the cemeteries, the eyes of the massacred Memorial Day marches come out of cul-de-sacs. Mm-hmm. These hours, our activities, weld the atoms. I don't know what that's referring to. Joe Hill played, yes. Okay. The ashes of John Brown, the terrible reality, but the ashes lecture from the street corners. If we know that, if we know about those ashes, you know, and certainly because of Truman Nelson and other people, right? Speeches of Eugene Debs light the cells of political prisoners. Almost every stanza has something to give people some hope that even with these horrible things that are left out, they should be in there, but there's hope. And then, you know, and kitchen, the last line, kitchen kettles sizzle with people's brewing. Well, they're having meetings and they're making coffee,
mm-hmm.
and they're thinking, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just wanted to...
Yeah, that's spot on, Dorothy.
Yeah, but you know, it's really the people themselves are brewing. They're the kettle. You know,
mm-hmm.
The people are brewing. They're about to sing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At the end of that letter, he says, "So, if I have any advice whatsoever to give you, it would be this. Give yourself the time and the chance to think about some of what you've gone through in the last 10 years in your union, your political activities, your struggles to get published, your personal life. Let that anger and indignation still burn, but first let it be like a beacon, too, creating light as well as heat."
I love that. Creating light as well as heat.
Yeah,
that says it all.
It does.
Right.
Now, this was the guy who came up with, he was called to Gloucester by Gordon's to come up with, he was a chemist.
Huh. Is he in the picture? Is he in the picture? With
No. He was a chemist, and they knew each other through some political thing, and he was a guy who could solve problems. Mm-hmm. And he came up with the packaging for frozen foods that you could print up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so just
and it's the same formula that's used for milk cartons.
So was he connected with Birdseye?
No, he was just...
Just look at his biography at the end of the book. He just did everything.
Yeah.
He could do anything.
Did he stay here?
No. He was from Chicago.
He
just visited, you know, and he must have known Vincent through some political something, you know, because that's... But we don't know because we don't have any earlier letters. We just have the stuff from... You know, from later.
But what terrific advice to a political poet.
Mike
it's unbelievable.
Yeah. It is.
This is worth more than $8.
I'll take it. Nine.
He was one of the foremost authorities in the country on solving printing problems.
Yeah. But he was also, like, he worked for this newspaper, the Chicago Star, which was run by a guy named Frank Marshall Davis, who was a
I think people used to be like that.
Poet, yeah. Right, really.
More. That they could, they tinkered with everything. You know, people used to tinker with everything.
But you got to picture the scene here in this, with this correspondence. This is...
The correspondence is amazing. Oh, I know what I wanted to say about why Vincent didn't respond to him.
You don't know if he didn't, because we don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure he responded, but we don't know. There's no letters. We don't...
There were letters.
No way to find Vincent's
letters. There were letters. They were destroyed.
No, we don't know what happened to the letters that Vincent sent to Mike Hay.
Maybe he asked them to be destroyed.
Not at that point. Not in this...
Okay.
Earlier ones would have been.
Right.
But not from then. You know, I got in touch with his family.
Okay, I believe
you.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find any.
That's too bad.
Yeah, which is really too
not
bad.
One? Not a one?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Vincent answers the letter by his rest of the life.
Exactly.
His
and his poems, right.
He took the guy's advice because, I mean, Vincent's always leaving it open. We had in the last meeting. The forge plant, where, what does he say in forge plant? There's nothing that's impossible for you.
Yeah.
Does anybody
nothing
have
is
that
impossible selective? For you, the voice of Holocaust.
Yeah. So Vincent took
unconscious
that to heart.
Unconscious, oh, workers of your genius, and breathing something like giants, energies paid by war. Why have you never worked like this in peace?
And it's
they continued to write to each other until the time that Vincent died. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they maintained a friendship. So there was no, you know, criticism, you know.
I was just projecting that.
Where was he?
There were some letters, maybe. He didn't.
Was he up here at all? Like in the 2000s?
He came a couple of times.
Oh, really?
He made a couple of trips.
Did you meet him?
No, I
didn't. When did he die?
In my books.
2009.
I'm going to force him to read my books.
Oh, really?
All right, so I want to say something, too. When I read this, Trees Dropped, Lynch Negroes Coming to Life, this is why I love Vincent Farini. You can check out the hottest Poetry Prize winners right now. There are so many poets now that are published. There's by the thousands in Omaha and all these places. Right? And that's not going to be there. That is a concern that you don't even find in movies. You don't find it in newspapers. I mean, you have, it's surrealism.
Because he's saying the word coming to life?
You got it, Dorothy.
Right.
That's surrealism. Mm. Surrealism always has, to not be confused with just the Dalí, Magritte thing. Surrealism has always had a moral concern with freedom and with racism and apartheid. Mm-hmm. They have always, the Surrealist group has stood up with women, with indigenous people, with black people, from the first meetings. And this is just that line alone, and Dorothy, you brought it in, how that like optimism that he keeps going into. So can you imagine the Ludlow butchered walk the streets now? Well, in a way that they do, because the people that were massacred at Ludlow had children. We are connected to, all of us are connected to this because we live here. This is our past, so we come out of this. I mean, we do live on from this stuff. So can you imagine like how many people I'm related to that were lynched? Think about it. I mean, and you all too. You're related to these people, and it's not disconnected, and we walk around with it every day. So that's why I think Vincent is seriously important, because who does that? Who says stuff like that? I remember seeing Henry Farini on 4th of July, reading this poem to him in Cambridge on 4th of July. So,
Henry,
what's that, Independence Day?
Where in Cambridge?
Yeah. We were on, I don't know where we were. This one. What the Books Left Out. I read it to you on 4th of July.
Well, you know, in publishing this thing too, I also thought it was so important to just get at least some of these poems from this period available, because
they're so valuable.
Yeah. Vincent was, this period of Vincent particularly was actually, you know, the communists came down on him because he had left the party. I mean, he got a vicious review, you know, by Thomas McGrath.
Wow.
At some point, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And so he was disowned on all sides.
Yeah, right. He was.
So it was really, you know, these books just disappeared.
Mm. No, I think that's why it prompted his move to Gloucester. You know?
Yeah.
You know, the what was happening at GE, but
yeah, also
GE,
he was kind of just, you know, he was cast adrift,
yeah,
you know, in a lot of ways, because he wasn't towing the party line.
Mm. He needed to be free for to be a poet, right?
And these are such important poems, you know, from this period.
Right. I mean, he did try with all his heart to do what could help, you know, people to have a better life with his writing. And you know, there weren't many groups trying to bring about change in the world except the CP at that point.
Sure, but it's such a testament to the time, you know, these poems. You can get historical things that you don't get anywhere else. You just don't get them because of his point of view, because it's not...
They are. And you made great selections.
Yeah.
There's one selection that I can't remember. Here's my note, but I don't remember which poem it goes to. Reminds me of Fritz Lang's film Metropolis, because of the way he describes the workers. That one scene where they're all lined up in front of an elevator, ready to go down or something.
I think I know the one you mean.
Yeah, well, see if you can find it so I can put the little post-it with. Which one would that be?
The one on page 34 that's called The Madness of Reality.
Yes, that's a great poem.
That's like, he's in it.
Does anybody want to read it?
Read it, Liz.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, hell, give it a try. Madness of Reality. Worry for work and walk and sleep in iron straitjackets. Fight to earn enough to keep the body alive and hungry mouths. Oh, the earth is here for all the people. But the few have stolen the rich resources and guard them with laws, police, and lies. Walk and worry for work and sleep in iron straitjackets. Screwed with worries to achieve arteriosclerosis, old age, and homelessness, and a coffin you have saved for. Oh, to die never discovering ourselves, deaf and dumb and blind to the beauty of being alive. Why must the years be lost when the earth screams at the abundances for all to share alike so that man can begin to live? And the millions upon millions worry for work and walk and sleep in iron straitjackets with a knife in the head, dead before we were born.
That's good enough.
Well, it's like he's in it.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. And, you know, yeah, sometimes, now and then, you know, When I was younger, I worked at jobs like that, but I knew I could get away. But this was, you know, this was the world that boxed them in all over.
Right. Now,
but he still was thinking of the beauty.
But on page 37, the end of Wine of the Heart, the last stanza, "We shall be together so long it will seem like yesterday, for the blood of the tenements stopped and ours were the hands removing the knife."
Yeah.
Oh, fuck, man.
So. Good.
Okay, that was a great reading. About the common.
Yeah, that was great.
The world is a common, and it has been stolen from us. We are already alienated from ourselves. You know what? I'll just speak for myself. I'm alienated from my friends, from myself, and from the world. There are things in between me and what gives us energy. That's food. I mean, who really has? I mean, maybe you all do, but I don't have a good diet. My diet is nowhere near what I would want it to be. Why? Because I gotta wake up. I gotta wake up at 6. I gotta go, right? You gotta get there. I mean, I work in a place where it's so hip and cool and everything that there's no lunch break. I mean, I'm serious.
That cool?
I'm serious.
Yeah.
So, I have to bring up this thing about the common which we are involved in. I know Willie has heard me sing this, and Jim and Henry and Annie, but I believe this is really crucial to what Vincent's talking about. The law locks up the man or woman who stole the goose from the common, but lets the greater villain loose who stole the common from the goose.
That's great.
That's great.
So, if you go for a walk, I mean, for example, I worked yesterday in Brookline, and somehow I got from my home to Brookline Village, and I didn't walk one time. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
No, because a walk is not when you're trying to get on the commuter rail. A walk isn't when you're trying to get to work on time. A walk isn't when you're trying to hurry really quick to like get 5 fucking minutes away. A walk is what you do when there's the destination is the walk. And that's really what walking is about. You're not rushing to the movie. You're not going anywhere but to the walk itself. And what happens when you actually go for walks is your health increases and your energy increases and you can be aware of the world that you live in. And this is what he's saying, deaf and dumb and blind to the beauty of being alive. If you're fixated on getting somewhere on time, if you're fixated on eating, this would be an example for a date, right? You don't show up to a date hungry. The hell? I mean, can you imagine? Hey, I want to cook dinner for you. Or somebody says, I want to cook dinner for you, right? Do you go to the dinner hungry? I mean, that's absurd. No, you snack before the dinner so you're not fucking scarfing down the food that's made.
There are a lot of various levels of hunger, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm trying to say is when I'm eating in this rat race, when I eat...
Where is that line?
Which one?
I know it's in here. The one you just quoted about just be so grateful to be alive.
Oh, it's deaf. the deaf and dumb and blind to the beauty of being alive.
Deaf.
So we owe to die never discovering ourselves.
You were just saying that. You just read from that.
It's halfway down.
So I'm just trying to bring up that we actually are involved in a common, and it doesn't matter how many fences they put up, it doesn't matter how many develops try to enclose, the world is always a common. That's why in my backyard, Kim, like I told you on Tuesday, there are 4 different birds that eat in my backyard. They don't fight with each other, they don't put up fences about it, they pick here, they pick there, and it's fucking beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always present, this common that I'm talking about. This is like an old thing. The common's an old thing that you guys can That's what, when they said like Dogtown Common or Boston Common, yeah. The Common used to be a place that, because before we were set up for Market Basket and set up for whatever the, where's our, who's the water, what's the water, or
well,
National Grid.
Oceans were also all these commons too, Gabe, you know. The
exactly.
Fishermen were able to go out on those commons and to, you know, bring back enough fish to, you know, feed the community, but now those commons are...
And everybody brought their cows to Boston Common.
Thank you.
Yeah, and their sheep, that's what the commons were for.
Right, but it's a New England thing, right? Because every town had a militia, and the militia trained in the common.
Well,
right?
it is, and it's also, an earthly thing.
Right.
I mean, there were commons in Ireland, there were commons in England. I'm getting that the law locks up the man or woman who stole the goose from the common, but lets the greater villain loose who stole the common from the goose. That's 16th century England, and you can read a book called London Hanged by Peter Linebaugh, mm-hmm. where he talks about women being hung for eating the food in the common because the common was enclosed. And I just...
Mary Dyer was hung in the common.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I know that statue.
The statue's there, yeah.
I
she was hung in the common. Mary Dyer was hung in the common. There are statues in front of the
what
Capitol.
What common?
The Boston Common.
The Boston.
She was hanging in 1640, I think, for religious reasons. And her statue's still there.
Here's one on page 29, which is... We were talking about this a little bit before. The seeds of prophet bloom... The stars are tears of soldiers and sailors with hearts chewed by scrap sent from America on graveyard islands of names, like undersea sharks, oil of these ports nosing for fascist Spain feed the Nazi grin. Oh, what beast breathes under the skin of this atmosphere? The earth gags, blood falls from the tears of the stars, the trees weep, the tide tightens with ague, and the soil refuses to bear. O brothers of our unsuspecting victims, let our wrath become an octopus around the throats of the owners of this oil.
Wow. Wow. It's very timely.
Yeah. Okay.
the climate change thing.
Yeah.
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 So if you that's ecology, and that's mm-hmm. the
yeah.
one reason why a common works is it's ecological and it balances itself out. That's why that's what I was saying about those little birds. They don't fuck up the backyard because they know that's you don't shit where you sleep or something. I mean, they take care of it.
Yeah.
That's so good, man. Yeah. So, Vincent's what? So, Amiel, what's our date like on this?
On that?
Yeah, I mean, like...
That is...
43 or something?
43, yeah. 40, probably 40, probably four, in the early 40s.
Martin, right. What did you want to say?
Well, I'm just finding all this hugely distressing. And to bring it in to the little bit that I know about Vincent, I think that he simultaneously called for a shift in consciousness. Because I don't think that you can have a commons with a common attitude. What's commonly an attitude, because if the ocean is a common, everybody gets to go out and sweep up as many fish as they can catch. You see, there's no
that's
the only
not a
incentive
common, though.
is to get what you can, because there's not really a sense of ownership about it, right? It's just like it's there. And within the first couple decades of the establishment of Gloucester, almost all our common lands was gone. Because...
the first couple decades?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Well, except for this, any of the desirable land...
It's taken hundreds of years. There wasn't much desirable land here because it's all granite. So there's not great farming soil here, and that's why people were... fishing here. I mean, that's part of the reason
okay,
why people
but the,
were fishing, not farming.
There was a certain amount of arable land that was around where Blackburn, I mean, Grand Circle is now, and, you know, going up around the railroad tracks and certain other places. But the point was that anybody who was considered a citizen was granted ownership of parcels, right? So
no, not true. You had to be a member in good standing of the church to have land. And if you were not, you were not going to get land.
Well, okay.
So it's not everybody didn't get land.
But it was the parish, right? There were different parishes in town.
Well, first there was just one. And then people didn't want to cross the river. So they made a second one.
Can we just see where Martin is going with
it? Yeah, okay. But I'm just saying that some of your facts aren't really lining up.
Well, what was the thing? What did you mean, though, about the consciousness?
I certainly don't want to divert into that, but I have done a good amount of reading about, you know, about colonial history and that kind of thing. But I don't want to dispute that. What I was trying really to introduce is that and this is, I think, a major point in Vincent's life, is that without the shift of consciousness, so that you have, you know, more of a collective sense of belonging to a community, then anything that's unregulated is going to get consumed as fast as possible, I think. Okay?
But Martin, this is all regulated. The whole thing, that oil's regulated. That's regulated. I mean, we already have, it's like we already have regulation.
But that's your point, isn't it, Martin?
I think...
It's
kind of half of my point, right?
And Henry said we need to be responsible in our community.
Yeah. But how do you?
What change of consciousness makes us responsible? You know.
Can you say it again?
What is the consciousness that makes us responsible? We're so sadly lacking that on a collective level.
Right. It's a really really hard thing to make to maintain. I mean.
Kind of do unto others how you'd like to be done unto yourself. You know?
Exactly.
Well, some of it does. I think some of it does go on. Some of it does go on.
So rampant capitalism.
But also, you know, an understanding of the land and the ecology, which, you know, I guess as we go on, hopefully, in years, we understand more about how the ecology works and what it needs to survive. And I think there still is a great misunderstanding amongst the general people about what the earth needs to survive, what this land needs to survive, what the ocean needs to survive. So I think that consciousness needs to change if we are going to stay alive as a people on the earth.
Right.
So, Martin, you said that something was like distressing you about what I was getting on. So.
Because I don't think you can wish for a kind of a social economic system without a similar shift in how people participate in it, right? And
right. I mean, I know just what you're talking about, because it's a very powerful dominant culture in America that people are totally tied up. I don't want to say totally, because there's a lot of good things going on all over this country where people work in common together and have tried off and on throughout the years. And we have to keep remembering that, like this man was writing about, just not lose sight of the fact that it's possible to have a better world. And I think that's what Vincent believed too, because I don't think he was cynical. I don't think he was. I don't think he was a.
No, I think I said. I think
he wasn't.
Vincent was also. Any kind of sustainability also involved like self-sustainability, changing consciousness to act differently.
Right.
You know, and that was part of his whole thing.
Well, he talked a lot about.
I mean, taking it to a sort of cosmic level of fructification, and then in his later years, and then the family unit and the love that you gave to the children, and then that moved into a bigger community, and then he kept seeing it expanding into a higher consciousness, but through the family and
this one book that's called The Community of Self.
Yeah,
Henry, what's the quote of Annie just said from your film, from Truman Nelson, where he says D.H. Lawrence talks about the true the true poet is one who can transform a community from their self, from themselves.
To live in a living, breathing community and transform it. And then he goes on to say that Vincent did that.
The word community was always at the tip of his tongue.
Yeah, it was.
Hmm. He used it all the time.
Participation is a big word for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then his action was to speak up. He would go to the city council and speak out, and to speak out to anybody who would listen.
Yeah, I mean, participating. How intimately do you participate in your food, in your shelter, in the water you drink, in how your house is lit, and who you and how you communicate?
It's so lost, you know, the little kids, you go into the school and you say, where does your food come from? And they say, oh, the grocery store.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so lost. People are not connected to the earth anymore, are not connected to what sustains them.
Amiel, I'm thinking about that Gino Clays, mm-hmm. where that's one of the huge things he really liked about, Olson really liked about Gino Clays, because he said, like, once you start going across the land with no acknowledgement of what you're crossing, instead of going into the land, then you're fucked. Basically, I mean, that's what Olson's big.
Gabe, you gotta hear when Ian Sinclair was here. Were you here? Did you hear him?
I was here, yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Just the podcast of that. I just remember his talking about the sort of the depth and the layers of the land and the mm-hmm. river that's running underneath the land that's been fenced off, mm-hmm. but you can't. It was great stuff.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what Martin... That's like kind of what I mean. It's we are whatever you guys want to call each other. We're humans or whatever you want to call each other. But we mean we're not the whole world. And just because we're absolutely insane and treat each other poorly, it doesn't mean that the groundwater, like Paul, hey, the groundwater.
That's Paul's book of poems, by the way.
The groundwater?
Yeah. The groundwater's not nutty, and actually, if you look at cosmically, we're the nuts ones, and we're not the majority. We're a minority of
bacteria
insanity.
Is the majority. They're going to win.
Yeah.
Anyway,
what is
the
bacteria?
Bacteria. Well, speaking of bacteria, I'm a little hungry.
Yeah.
And I'd like to read this. Onions and bread. Oh, I always thought it was bread and onions, though. It's
well, that's the
19.
Great novel.
Yeah.
That's
onions and
no,
bread.
No, bread and wine.
Bread and rice.
1936. I think it was 23. He wrote this.
I know that's so.
What is it? Bread and wine.
Yes, it's
yeah.
Sillyon.
Thank you, Adore.
But
so long,
that's
yeah.
mentioned by somebody in this book.
So,
go ahead.
I've never read a poem like this
what
by
page?
Vincent Perrine. 19. Onions and bread. Around tenement tables underfed, living voices of the dead, eat onions and bread, sons and daughters still unwed, streets of graves and stairs that tell, husbands hunt work, families not well, fears of poorhouse fall and swell, from relatives' kitchens to homes of hell. Headaches, mouths to feed, heavy feet, anger in faces we meet. Time gone, always same place in the street. No work, how long will the stories repeat? Caught between pay and no pay, tortured for welfare aid each day. Words, grains of hope against decay. Life is short, time to stay. Ancestral names bear the same fate, though, funerals of the new, the old and new. This can't go on forever. We grew to die not having lived. We have our due.
We
must
have
our due.
Thanks, Henry.
Vincent's always, you know, that refrain of not the people not having the time to live is... Always in his work.
I mean, did he complain about working for the General Electric Company? You know, like he was 9 to 5 and he had
yes.
to do all that stuff?
Yeah, and he said if we
when
can take charge,
home?
you know, we can determine how many hours we're going to work, and we can have time for leisure.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very acutely aware of that. I just wanted to mention, as far as community too, is the unions were so important to him. Mm-hmm. And he had very strong union feeling from his experience.
This is a, I love the way you read it, Henry. It's really just the way it rhymes so relentlessly.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But he does it well. It doesn't turn into doggerel. The rhyming is more like, you know, sort of marching feet or something.
A cadence.
Yeah.
What's that?
It's like a cadence.
Yeah.
Let's send that poem to George.
George, yeah.
George who?
George Sibley. George does these doggerel poems. And some of them are great, but he would like it.
He would. I'll show it to him.
Okay, there's another thing that keeps coming up in each poem that we've read. To die not having lived.
Yeah.
We must have our due. So, at the same time that I think the only reason why you would want to change your situation is if you like knew how to have fun, if you knew that there was more, you knew that things tasted better. And so the part of Vincent too is like he was like Dionysus or Dionysian or like a Bacchus almost, like a reveler, a wastrel. He liked to, from my understanding and feeling of him, is that he knew how to have a good time and he liked to enjoy his self.
Well, it's interesting coming from the Italian culture he grew up in. I mean, he talked about the people making wine, you know.
And there was celebration, I think. I mean, we're getting all the dark, totally, but say more about that, Henry, because you know more about that.
Well, when I was, a child sitting around a big table like this with all the relatives in Lynn, it was just always politics. And, of course, Vincent, held forth. And there was, it was festive, but it wasn't Dionysian.
No, but food and wine.
Family, but food and wine, yeah, big time. Food
but Henry,
and wine
what
and
about,
politics.
What about him, though, like in that... your film.
Oh, that Dionysian
the best party
setup
that ever,
I did.
Yeah.
Well, I set that up for him. That was his fantasy.
And he said he could die right now.
Yeah.
But that was sex.
Yeah, that was
which is important.
I think people make.
And if you're working all the time, you cannot be fucking all the time. And if you're fucking all the time, you do not want to go to work. It's just how it works, man.
You do have him when retired, right? I mean, there's a time when he worked, and then he wants to retire and become a poet and became an artist. So we know him like as you know him as a worker, right? You probably knew he worked at factory Monday through Friday and weekends with a family or whatever, but he didn't have that. Jean de Vivre till he got out, till he was retired.
I think he probably did.
No,
I think he always had it.
Gloucester.
All the time.
But he didn't complain about 9 to 5.
He was framing.
But it was his own job. It was his own craft. He owned the business.
That was later, though. Didn't he work for a corporation first?
Well, back when he lived in Lynn.
He worked as a kid for 9 years.
And that was the first time.
But he still went to the beach and swam in the ocean.
During a hurricane.
Well, he was a human being, right? But I just want to throw this in there, and it's just my feeling. And I feel like what I love about these two meetings that we've had so far is that we've really focused on his ideas and his work and what he believed in and his vision. And the part of him that I think has been neglected.
Yeah.
And I feel that sometimes it's been too much. You know, I found this card. We had this 100th anniversary for Vincent. And I did the best I could to get the best talks from everybody. And I don't know if any of you have seen the videos or anything, but there was a couple people, I asked them all to send summaries of what they were going to talk on the panel for the 100th anniversary. Mm-hmm. This was a first effort to have...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great effort.
It was
to
great.
Have scholarship... and recent readings of his work. And a couple people didn't send me their stuff. They didn't prepare. And one person you know, it was really disturbing to me what he said. He said something like, "I offered my daughter to Vincent," you know. And that was in Cape Ann Museum, which was loaded with 200 people. And, you know, he thought he was being, was that Peter Cook? I think it was.
Yeah, I was there, but I didn't hear that. I'm glad I didn't.
Oh, I heard it. I almost
Peter wanted to... Kidd?
Peter Kidd, right.
Yeah.
He didn't prepare anything.
He just...
This was a and I mean, a lot of people did, like you mentioned. That's the
David Rich
prepared, and Peter Anastas prepared, and there are other people that really had, and James
Warren
Cook,
and
I mean, yeah. Some people prepared more than others, but we're really making progress here, and
yeah, we are.
And I think he was just a human being. I mean, he had a very painful life, so the joy that he wanted to experience the joy of life. He could always offer people, you know, a joyful presence. Mm. And that's what he wanted, you know, that's almost a Unitarian thing, right? I mean, that, you know, no matter what, you know, there's a joy of being alive. And, but I think it's time to move on from, you know, this Dionysian interpretation and separating. He's just, he's a whole human being, right?
Well, I don't think we should separate it, but I want to incorporate it because that was part of him. I mean, Dionysian's probably not the right word, but that sense of the universe fructifying and, you know, his love of sort of intense experience and you know, sexuality was in there big time.
That is so huge, because like when you are a worker, that has nothing to do with you being a human being at all. They're trying as hard as they can to get your body to be a machinery, and it does not care about your belly. I mean, in his autobiography, that was the first time I realized, you know, about shitting and work and what the connections between shitting and work are. Do you guys know this?
Yeah, it's tough.
It's really tough because you're, what are you, so when it happens, it happens, right? Like going to the bathroom, that, you know, you can't really, maybe you can get it good. When you don't have to be, this is what I have to say. When you don't work in the morning, when you don't work early in the morning, it's, you can get into a rhythm, and your body has a fluid rhythm, your digestion. But when you work really early in the morning, it's not as easy. And he talks about this in his autobiography, working at the GE plant, and about having issues shitting at GE, because the GE does not recognize humanity. That's not the point of... Yeah. Capitalism is not to recognize humanity. And I am not deprecating Vincent when I'm talking about the Dionysus and the dancing, because I know the last event we had was the dancer.
Yeah.
The incredible dancer.
Right. Dancing was a big thing for him.
What I mean is that if you're a total human being, you are useless to our society. If you're a total human being. If you dance, if you eat, if you think, if you have your senses with you, there's no use for you. Mm-hmm. I don't go into my job and talk like I'm talking to you. There's no use for that. I'm not going to get into the frame shop I work at and start talking like this, because immediately it's like, hey, let's go outside. Let's fire Gabe or whatever. I just am quiet. And I'm like ascetic towards being a total human being. And I wonder, Amiel, if you know, or Vincent, or Henry, Annie, if he had Herbert Marcuse's one-dimensional man in his, because I'm certain that Vincent would have read that. And Dorothy, when you're saying total human, this is what Marcuse is talking about, that we are fully human. We are not automatons. We're not ostracizer blenders. And don't get it confused, because that's what people want you to be. They want you to be like machinery. And
he was very disciplined.
Yeah.
He led a very disciplined life. He wrote,
wrote every
morning and every single day of his life. And answered letters. I'd get letters from him saying, I am overwhelmed with correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
It's when he got home from California or something. You know. And he was going to answer every one of those letters. And individually. None of this Christmas newsletter where you send the same newsletter out to everybody.
Or an email, the same one to everybody.
Although he did send his chain letters. He was going to make a million with his chain letters.
But in some ways, I think you really have a really... It's so funny because this comes through things that I do. Like one day, I knew Peabody Essex had a library. It was closed. So I kept pushing for it to, you know, find out where it was. It was down in Salem for a while. And they finally put it up in Raleigh. And it's only because I called them and it had opened, they had the opening and everything. So I went up there. And you're allowed in. You put your bag in this closet. And then you go up and knock on the door. And woman opens it and you go in. And then you have to tell them what you want to see, because it's really basically a closed library. And so I wanted some stuff. And then she went and got these papers that didn't have it. It was the son of this captain I was, you know, that I got. So I have the computer, and then I start looking at it, at the work on the computer. And then I want to take notes. So there was a pile of like used papers on the windowsill next to me, and it was like I could see white. And they said, you know, scrap paper, 8.5 by 10. So somebody must have done something that was junk. You know, they looked for stuff and they threw it out. I turn it over, the first sheet. I'm just curious. And it has this lady's name, 16-something. She lives in Ipswich. She was born in England. She came over on the Mayflower. It's her will.
Oh, my gosh.
So here's just maybe page one. So I take the next one. I turn it up. It was all in order. So I go, God, they're throwing the stuff out. It was just, you know, repeats. Somebody was doing research, and it was like, you know, the will was like, you would say, my money, my car, my house, my belongings, my children, they'll get the... She had everything itemized, stuff that we would throw away and take to glance. And that's the kind of life they led then. And you say that they're different then, or, you know, that they were more into beauty. She had her down quilt, her sheet, how many pillowcases, the silverware. Imagine itemizing all these little things, because to them it was precious stuff.
Have a lot of things.
I know, it was very precious.
Noises.
And look
what
we throw away, and we don't even see this as being precious, but we delegate lines or, you know, like territory. Everybody had a commons. Every village had a commons.
Yes,
it was just,
Elizabeth.
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
You know, you got it.
But these people would enumerate down to the a stick or a chair or a spoon, and we think that they were living the la-la life, you know?
No, no.
Who knows that?
We don't think
that. They suffered to be there.
Oh, no. I mean, kids actually had more fun if they were captured by the Native Americans than if they stayed at home in the Puritan household.
Gone to Croatan.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Straight up. Gone to Croatan. This is a... You got it.
Well, Hutchinson was captured by the Indians, and she didn't get touched.
Oh, you wanna,
but our military, we raped and we pondered.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Now we're
what you got, Amiel?
Well, I just wanted to say something about what's really... what we tried to do, and I just want to say Kate Morgan, my co-conspirator, really wanted to be here, but she broke her foot. So
dancing? How'd you do it?
No, she... Don't ask. It was just like... vacuuming down the stairs. Yeah, anyways, she's out of the boot in the bra. Anyways, she greets everybody. She really, really wanted to be here. But one of the things that we really tried to do here is Vincent is somebody who, you know, starts writing in the 30s, okay? And people who were writing in the 30s actually had an audience. Mm. They actually had an audience, especially, you know, class-wise. They could reach people. Mm. And what happens in this correspondence with Mike Hecht is both of these guys realize there's nobody out there. How the hell are we going to reach anybody? Mm. Okay, late 40s, no mass movement,
you know, no outlets. So all of these start to realize all of these people, Olson and, you know, Black Mountain and, you know, people starting little Four Winds, you know, they're trying to figure out how to publish themselves because nobody's going to publish them. Okay, so it's a totally different world. It's just like a totally different world. And there's this stunning letter here where Mike Heck is writing from Chicago, and they're, like, desperate. You know, they're talking about how they're going to try to start a magazine. It's 1950. And he says, I'm broke. I'm working for this paper. I'm doing this and that. I've got no money. And he says, they're talking about how to start a little magazine. And then he says, after this desperate letter on page 53, says, P.S., last night was perhaps the most encouraging and stimulating I've spent in the last 2 years. Now, Vincent is getting this sitting in Gloucester. Keep that in mind. From Chicago. At the Southside Community Arts Center, Jack Conroy presided over a mashaira. You know what is it, a mashaira? I didn't until I got there. It's a poetry fest. It's a South Asian thing. Poets got up, read their stuff, took it on the chin or on the back from the audience, which, though it numbered only about 50, came because they wanted to and thus contributed in a wonderful way with pungent criticisms, sharp observations on art and poetry, and gads of humor. Not knowing what it was, a mashaira, I came without any of my own poetry. Those who came armed were Gwendolyn Brooks, with selections from her street in Bronzeville, and Annie Allen, her husband, Henry Blakely, with a wonderful waggishness to mix with his poems, another Negro poet, Margaret Cunningham, a very nervous, young, shy poet named Paul Mills, who, while his poetry didn't have much content, had a polish that... Anyways, he goes on and on and on. And then he says, gets towards the end, and he's talking about Jack Conroy, and he says, if the next affair comes along, comes off, I plan to read from your work, Saul Funaroff and Alex Bregman, etc., etc. Now he says, after the poetry session broke up, we caught the tail end of a conclave between Paul Robeson and a group of theater people in the Negro community, where for the first time the battle that a few of us have been waging for 5 years with only bruised heads and bleeding hearts to show for our efforts has been taken up by a guy who can really put it over. So here's this guy who's looking at Paul Robeson as like the big shot who's come to the neighborhood, finally.
The big wheel.
You know, the big wheel. And he's writing this to Vincent in Gloucester. So he's getting this direct news, you know, sitting here in 1950, like totally direct. I mean, that is unbelievable.
It is. And you get it across about correspondence.
Yep.
There was all this correspondence that was going on. That, Constant letter writing.
And that was the news.
Yeah. And
that's what I meant about participating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or closer participation, like being more involved in participating in the fundamentals of life. Like communication is and expression is a fundamental. But that's all I wanted to say.
Oh my God! Yeah. It's, and he continued it, you know,
till
he died. And you know, maybe it wasn't having the same effect as far as. But who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
Because there was so much dialogue and discussion in all these letters. And
I mean, it's so cool too that like, how would he, the guy Heck, is not going to be writing this up on the newspaper he's working at. He's going out of his own love of poetry, right? So it's like, how is Vincent going to be at the 28th?
I'm getting mixed up. 126
East Main Street, and get hip to this. How do you say it? Mashaira.
Yeah.
With Paul Robeson on the street, unheard of poets that are later gonna blow up.
Brooks, yeah.
But that's not gonna be in the New York Times. It's not gonna be in the L.A. Times. It's not gonna be in the Gloucester Daily Times. He got it from
firsthand.
Yeah, who's like off. Duty reporter, and shoots it over to Vincent.
Now he's also, this guy Mike Heck is working under the editorship of Frank Marshall Davis. Mm-hmm. Frank Marshall Davis,
really?
after Hewitt goes after him, he moves to Hawaii.
Right,
he was Obama's mentor in Hawaii,
wow.
And that was scratched out of Obama's autobiography.
Wow,
he was an incredible jazz
well,
writer
because
as well.
He didn't want to have that in there. That's Gerald Horn said that at the opening of the CPUSA archive at NYU.
Oh, yeah.
He
didn't want to be too threatening.
So,
The last paragraph, he goes, I left with my head in the clouds. Truth is, I'm still drunk. Don't blame me if I sound giddy. History was made last night, and I was there shaking hands with it.
Oh,
that's great. Yeah.
Were you
going to
read something?
Yeah, there. I just wanted to see what was in, you know, since we're in Olson's brain here. You know, what does he have of Vince that's here? And they're just two books. I mean, I don't know if there's more that are missing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't know. Do you know, Gabe, in the
is
Ralph trying to get more?
No, so here's what's going on. Like, Wieners, Amiri Baraka, Garrett Lansing, Vincent Farini, they were hanging out with Charles Olson, and they were putting a lot of it's just not up to what he has. I mean, the Heavenly Tree Grows Downward edition we have here is from like 77. That's almost just like a placeholder for these people. We have no John Wiener's books in here.
But why is that?
What I'm asking is, did Ralph in his scholarship articulate books that he wanted to get, because the library is incomplete, right?
Right. Yeah,
so,
it's incomplete.
So are there, you know, placeholders for particular books that, because that's something that, you know, we should
I'm trying to say,
yeah.
Is that, like, what you're seeing of Vincent is not at speed with what Charles Olson had of Vincent, and it is a placeholder.
Hmm. So there is a listing though what books he had.
I know that there's a it's a piece of scholarship. This is Maud's scholarship.
Yeah, right.
So like if he was still alive, this thing would continue to have books.
Right, of course, but you know he isn't, and I'm just wondering what books
left out.
To, yeah.
Well, Jim Dunn can tell you, for example.
Yeah.
Because Jim Dunn knows about John Wieners, he can tell you which John Wieners.
So Andre sort of wanted to keep it all pure in terms of just what was in Olson's brain, right?
Or Ralph's brain. What was in Ralph's brain, actually, yeah.
Yeah,
or
so
what Ralph figured out.
Yeah.
So, like, I've always thought, well, why don't we just collect Wieners' books and Olson's books and have them here?
Mm-hmm.
But
we
there's
have
security
them
issues.
Oh, we could have them in a related materials.
Yeah.
I think we definitely should have all Vincent's books here.
Sure.
That's what you have to do. Like, he had, look at how huge this he amassed.
Those stuff,
exactly.
Yeah. You know,
he had Nerves. He had all those books that were the White Rabbit books by John Wieners. Olson had those. The same with Amiri Baraka. There isn't a copy of Blues People in here. But Charles Olson had Blues People. There's a copy of Black Music. Maud's doing a whole heck of a lot of work, and there's like stuff.
All right. Well, this is good for the Gloucester Writer Center to know that in Maud's old, this is the old catalog.
Yeah.
That he did have, Book of One, Five Plays, The Garden,
mm-hmm.
The House of Time, I Have the World, Injunction. So these are all of Vincent's stuff.
Oh,
so
have
they
but they're not here.
The
Plough and the Ruins, Sea Sprung, Square Root
Inn.
They're in the
so Ralph couldn't get them.
So we should bring them over here
yeah.
And get them in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're not in the Cape Ann Museum.
You have to find original. But that is really good to know.
Yeah, it is. And we have those books. We have a lot of those books.
Right.
Is there room to put them up here?
No, this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We make room.
Oh, yeah. We need to have the books here.
I was
reading your annual report Tuesday, and it said something like there's 3,000 books here, but there were 5,000 in his whole collection.
What? There are 4,500 or something.
You know, we have around 5,000 books here.
Yeah.
But there's some of them are reference books, and the Olson books are, you know, offhand what we have.
Of Charles Olson's books?
Library, yeah, not the reference books.
I mean, all I know is that there's stores and that Ralph Maud was trying to imitate the store's collection.
I think we have about 3,500 here.
And in books.
Yeah. Are there more books that aren't here on the walls that you have stored somewhere else?
No.
Not from the collection.
But there may be more books. There may be more books that he would have had that aren't here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyhow, these are I found two in the library now. I'm glad I went and looked for it. But this is one that from the Book of One, which is a beautiful book, done in 1960.
60, I was going to say, yeah.
And the first poem, Ralph didn't say anything about any of Vincent's books.
That's what I'm trying to say about how it's scholarship. He has so much to do. Ralph Maud had... this is a whole lot. That's why all of these things don't have.
Yeah, but he wrote in some, and he chose to not write in others. Right.
That's why I'm saying it's scholarship. That's scholarship. He has a focus. So
I thought that's like an. Okay.
Well, no, yeah. I'm not saying it in a
which I'm sort of interested in, which is Vincent, like totally to the max. It's called Threshold. And it starts with the birth of death, the rites by death, for the burial of death. And then?
And then?
Life. Yeah, that sounds like a Garrett Lansing poem. Yeah.
It's quite...
Very Vincent.
Very Vincent, yeah.
All right, I want to read the Tanny Bronson because I didn't get into it. Elizabeth, can I see your selected poems of, or Dorothy, can I see your copy of the selected poems?
The copy I just got from Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Can I do it?
So, Dorothy already brought up how we have the John Brown's ashes in the What the Books Left Out, and we spoke a little bit about Truman Nelson on last reading, but I just want to read... this poem, Tanny, what's up?
I'll just read from the intro where Vincent's talking about he describes himself then going to the public library with shoulder-length hair, arguing against eating any kind of flesh. Farini describes himself then, I am intense, a fanatic. I wear a long black coat down to my ankles, a black fedora hat, a black bag I fill up with library books I cannot part with. In the library, he meets the great dead, engaging them in long conversations. But he also meets Truman Nelson, a high school dropout whose father, John Wilson Nelson, worked as a barber. Somebody taps me on the shoulder. I look up and stare, a square face with Hamlet's hair. I gaze up at this man in a Civil War uniform. I see a chameleon mind. Truman Nelson is a tenant of the past, I of the future present. We are two frontiers. So that's
okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Amiel. This is Tanny Bronson. Everything in his protein brain touches, he breathes to life. Rooted in the revolution of 1776, palms calloused by pick and shovel, on the pulse of the people, are fists full of liberty. Poetry spills from his lips, and his consciousness is a sleepless eye. When he imitates people, your stomach knots with laughter. His criticism cuts the legs under you, hammers the time as it happens into songs for workers' ears. Old clothes need him. His head is a fawn's. Friend to square pegs and round holes, honest as the sting of truth, and suffers for it. In his house there is free speech. Wherever he is, the air blossoms, exciting you with a drama of stories, unending jokes, and anecdotes. His rooms are splashed with paintings. You are reborn when you hear him freeing music, and around his fireplace you chew a bit of greatness. With him, you become an explorer, the dormant universe electrified within you. His blood throbs with the untaught American past, bringing it back to the people.
Beautiful.
That was that person?
Yeah, Truman.
That was Truman Nelson, who
is really, really important and beautiful person. So I think it's almost at the end, or right? And I wanted to do this. Can you pass me the computer, Henry?
I just want to mention, Gabe had we were talking before, and he mentioned, which I knew, that Drummond Nelson wrote the foreword to Robert Williams's Negroes with Guns, which is a very important book. Robert Williams was a Second World War veteran who came back to the South and started a bunch of rifle clubs for self-defense. And when people talk about the civil rights movement and SNCC and Martin Luther King, they don't realize that there are a lot of guys in the woods with shotguns behind them that Robert Williams had organized. And Truman Nelson wrote the preface to that book.
And he also wrote The Torture of Mothers.
The Torture of Mothers, which is a very important book.
And I just finished reading, thanks to Henry, The Old Man, John Brown at Harper's Ferry, which is absolutely amazing. Got reprinted on the 100th anniversary of October 16th, 1859. That's John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry. But I wanted to do this at the end of the last class, but we just were getting too hot, so I didn't want to break it up. But that poem I just read to you was from No Smoke. This is like everybody knows this book. This is what the book, Garrett Lansing said, was Vincent's greatest book. But I want to share this with you all. And please excuse me for this confuser, like Willie would say. I know it's ugly and everything, but I don't have a... I'm not talking about like this computer per se, but just to have a computer out when we're talking about this stuff. So here we go.
At the east edge of town, at the foot of the hill, stands a chimney so tall, it says Aragon. But there's no smoke at all coming out of the stack. That mill has pulled out, and it ain't coming back. Now I'm too old to work, and I'm too young to die. Place to go for my old man and I, and there's no children at all in the narrow empty streets. The looms have all gone and it's so quiet I can't sleep. And only tune I hear sound of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. The mill has shut down, it's the only life I know. Tell me, where can I go? Tell me, where can I go? Only tune I hear is the sound of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. At the east edge of town, at the foot of the hill, stands a chimney so tall.
So what were the Aragon medals?
Where were they?
That was beautiful.
Was that Cleveland?
I'm going to say that it's in Utah, but you can find out because I don't really know. But Rosalie Sorrells is from Utah.
But yeah, and we can look up the Aragon Mill. But I don't know. I wanted to share that with you guys.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. That's a really nice note.
So how old is that recording?
Yeah,
that's
sure.
From,
that's YouTube, right?
Yeah, this is from 1996. But
okay.
That song.
So she's a contemporary.
Yeah,
singer.
Rosalie Sorrell's passed away recently, mm-hmm. But she was born in 1935 in probably Utah or Idaho. But that's like Willie probably knows. It's like a Aragon Mill. That's like a song that's age old, and that's why I think you know that album is called The Long Memory. So.
Mm.
That's the
cool.
Yeah.
It's a funk song?
Yeah.